Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests. And, well, today we have with us Paul Thompson. Now, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because I think you'll find this so fascinating. We really won't want to interrupt it. We've had Paul on for 2 hours the other night. Really hadn't a chance to explore these ideas. He's written a book called Terror Timeline. It's based upon what he's been able to glean off the internet and from other books that have been written about what really happened leading up to 9-1-1 and what happened after that. And you must understand that we've had two investigations that were not carried out by Congress to reveal what happened, but to conceal what happened. And if they were trying to conceal it, why did the 9-1-1 Commission conceal most of the testimony that was taken in secret, and then they classified it so nobody could know? If there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it? Why? Because, of course, it was 9-1-1 that brought us into this terrible war in Iraq, and is going to take us into the coming terrible war with Iran and with Syria, and will bring terrible consequences here in America. Because don't think you can sit in the comfort of your home while somebody else's home is being blown up or destroyed, or the people are being contaminated there with radioactive depleted uranium, and there will be no consequences for America. Men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And, of course, I believe terrible things are going to happen to America because of what happened leading up to 9-1-1. And that's why Paul Thompson has done such a great and important work in writing the book of Terror Timeline. Paul, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, Paul, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself? You actually are an American, but you're living at least at the present time in New Zealand and getting a lot of your information off the internet?
Yeah, that's correct. I did virtually everything. I like 5,000 source articles for this book, and I got just about all of them off of the internet.
All right, fine. So now, of course, you're trying to teach the American people. What is the very essence? What have you found? Haven't there been a lot of inconsistencies in what the government says and what you've actually been able to find from many sources?
Yeah, well, what I try to do is I try to be non-partial, and I don't want to make a lot of conclusions, but I would say that after I've done all this research, there are some different possibilities people might look at the book and conclude, but I think one possibility they're not going to come away with is an agreement with the official story. And when I talk about the official story, I mean statements like, you know, they hate us for our freedoms, or there was no way that attacks could have been stopped, or we had no idea planes could be used as weapons, or the attacks were only in the head of a few people. There are so many statements that have been made that are clearly untrue, and it's hard to know what the truth is, but I can say for a certain fact that most of these statements about 9/11 from top government officials are untrue.
All right, fine. Well, let's get back to the very beginning. Where does this story begin? It begins back about 79, doesn't it?
Yeah. The first, it's divided up into entries of about a paragraph each, and the first entry in the book is 1979, the invasion of Afghanistan. That was when the Soviet Union invaded, and they were engaged. They ended up in a long civil war with the Afghan rebels.
And, of course, this was really precipitated by Zbigniew Brzezinski from the Trilateral Commission, the front man for the Rockefeller interests, who actually intentionally precipitated this war by funding the Afghan Mujahideen, who were rioting and demonstrating and trying to overthrow the puppet Soviet government. And what we did was intentionally precipitate that war. First, we'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Paul Thompson. You can go to his website at cooperativeresearch.com. That's cooperativeresearch.com. And you'll certainly want to pull down his material off his website. But even better, hopefully, you'll want to buy his book, which we do carry. And it's called The Terror Timeline. And it is, how many entries are there in the book? How many?
Something like, I think, 1,500.
And these are all taken from articles and books that document the things that you're not getting from regular sources. In other words, the regular media is not telling you, but this is all available on the Internet or on books, and it tells an entirely different story than the American people have been told. And so the story really begins back in 1979 when there's the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviets, but it was really precipitated by the American government. By Zbigniew Brzezinski, and he admitted years later, about a decade later, in an interview with a French television station, that he had intentionally precipitated the Afghan war. Of course, he denied that up until then, but government officials a lie. Also, of course, you remember it was that same year, 1979, when we toppled the Shah of Iran, who was our friend, and brought into power the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was our enemy. Didn't make much sense then, now, but today, as we see ourselves moving into war with Iran, and that, I believe, that's just the next step, now it makes a lot of sense. We once again created the best enemy money could buy. But Paul, why don't you pick up the story of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and why that is so important to where we are today and the war on terror and Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden?
Well, as you pointed out, Brzezinski did later admit to fomenting the invasion, sort of tempting the Soviets in. And then for about 10 years, this war raged all throughout the 1980s, and the U.S. spent something like $6 to $40 billion on aid to the Afghan rebels.
How many people died in that war that Mr. Brzezinski precipitated intentionally by himself? How many people? We know there are 3 or 4 million people that were refugees. What, a million died or more?
It's hard to say. At one point, something like one-third of the entire population in Afghanistan were refugees, so there was a tremendous human toll.
A wonderful effect of American foreign policy carried out with our tax money. We created that war, and I believe it, about a million people died.
But I wanted to mention that if you look at it from a Machiavellian point of view, their goal was to help bring about the overthrow of the Soviet Union, sort of tap their resources.
Hold that thought right there.
Oh, sure.
Well, our guest is Paul Thompson. He is saying that, of course, they justified, the United States officials justified creating the war in Afghanistan. Of course, we couldn't tell the American people we created it. About a million people, as I remember, I've got the documentation on this, died, and half the population of 15 million were refugees, and many of them are still refugees from the terrible war that we created. But the justification, according to Paul, is that, well, of course, this was going to bring about the downfall of the Soviet Union. And, of course, then it was all worth it as long as we were able to bring down the Soviet Union. Well, at least that's what we're telling the American people. So pick up the story from there, Paul.
Yeah. You could say that, and this is what Brzezinski later claims, is he calls it a big success because he says it helped bring down the Soviet Union. However, all that aside, you have to look at the side effects. And a tremendous side effect was that we essentially created an army, tens of thousands of strong, of Afghan rebels who came from actually all over the Muslim world to go join what they considered to be a holy war. And so we trained generally the most fundamentalist, most radical, the most anti-Western out of the bunch. And when the war was over, they all went back to their home countries, and a lot of them became very destabilizing forces. Many of them became terrorists later. So you look at Osama bin Laden, Al-Qaeda, and so many others, people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind, they all got their start in Afghanistan, largely in a U.S.-funded operation.
All right. So the United States really funded this through the CIA. We gave the money to the Pakistanis, and they funded it, and the Saudis. But this was our war. And of course, during that war, didn't we actually encourage this radical form of Islam and try to indoctrinate these people about how wonderful it was to die for Allah and they go to heaven with your 74 virgins or whatever it was? Weren't we actually pushing this radical form of Islam?
Yes, well, that's what I was alluding to earlier. It wasn't so much that we pushed it, although there were even textbooks made that the U.S. made that kind of pushed this ideology. But it was more a case of that the U.S. was giving all of its money to Pakistan, and Pakistan would then turn and give that money to Afghanistan. And Pakistan had their own agenda, and you could say that to a lot extent they were using the U.S. For their own purposes, and they were the people in the Pakistani intelligence agency, the ISI, they were very radical. They shared the same Wahhabist, sort of very fundamental view of Islam. And so we really fed right into that, and we gave them all the money to essentially promote the most fervent, most radical people, like, what's his name? Hektakmar, do you know who I'm referring to?
I'm referring, right.
He continues to this day to be a warlord who is very much opposed to the U.S. The U.S. tried to assassinate him a year or two ago with a missile, but he was largely taken out of obscurity and put into a position of great power thanks to the United States and the Pakistanis. And we ended up creating our own enemies.
But of course, you actually, in your book, you quote the Prime Minister of Pakistan, Bhutto, who actually said, you're creating a Frankenstein, referring to the fact that we were training all these radical Islamic warriors and all sorts of terrorist techniques and how to make explosives. And of course, many of those same people who were trained to make explosives taught the people who did some of the bombing right here in the United States.
Yeah, well, Bhutto was sort of at odds with her own intelligence agency. The ISI is extremely powerful. It's called a state within a state. And she had a more moderate line, and the United States basically allied with these very fundamentalist people in the ISI, in the intelligence agency. So at the time, people like her and others, It wasn't some sort of, you know, great secret. You could see that the U.S. was kind of creating a monster, as she put it.
Today we call those people terrorists, but of course in those days we call them allies.
Yeah.
All right, fine. So then what happened? Of course, the war ended, the Soviets pulled out, and of course withdrew to the Soviet Union, and of course Afghanistan is just a state of total chaos. I mean, close to a million people are dead. Maybe half the population has been forced to leave their homes, living as refugees in camps, either in, in Iran or in Pakistan, and so then what happens?
Well, the U.S. considered that their strategic interest was done, and they basically abandoned Afghanistan. And so Afghanistan was embroiled in many, sort of just an endless civil war. You could say that the fighting has really never stopped in Afghanistan since it began in 1979. And finally, the ISI again in Pakistan, around 1994, they decided to create the force called the Taliban, and they put the Taliban together, and it was basically completely their puppet, and the Taliban slowly took over Afghanistan over the next few years, and then Osama bin Laden came back in.
All right, but now, of course, didn't the United States help to fund the Taliban, at least with humanitarian aid? Because I can remember President Bush on the 20th of September 2001 saying the United States is the largest source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan, but the Taliban controlled all of Afghanistan, except maybe for 10% where the Northern Alliance was, so we must have been funding the Taliban, at least with humanitarian aid.
Yes, well, there's a long and tailed story. I have a chapter in my book about it called Pipeline Politics that looks at the U.S.'s sort of a love-hate relationship with the Taliban. There were certain strategic interests in the U.S. certain forces here that wanted to see the Taliban take over the country so that the country could be stable and things like pipelines could go across the country without any rebels destroying the pipeline.
Well, then wasn't it to our advantage to have a strong Taliban if they would let us build the pipeline?
Yeah, but then on the other hand, there were people opposing the Taliban, complaining about their human rights record, their abuse of women. So the Clinton administration sort of vacillated back and forth. Some forces within the government were helping the Taliban, other forces were hurting them. And I should also point out that under the Bush administration, about a short time before 9/11, I think it was May or something like that, they gave tens of millions of dollars to the Taliban in direct aid as a reward for drastically reducing their drug output.
So actually we're financing the Taliban is what you're saying, we're giving them money.
Yeah, that one donation was their largest foreign aid contribution by far. So we were very instrumental in a lot of ways in propping up the Taliban.
Of course, we're worried about, of course, the mistreatment of women in Afghanistan, but aren't women mistreated in Saudi Arabia? We're worried about the dictatorship in Afghanistan, but isn't there a dictatorship in Saudi Arabia? Worried about, of course, the chopping off of hands and feet in Afghanistan, but don't our allies in Saudi Arabia do exactly the same thing under Sharia law?
Well, they do, and also people have sort of lost the attention on Afghanistan. But if you look at Afghanistan today, the acclaimed Afghan government led by Hamid Karzai actually controls most of the city of Kabul, the capital, and that's about it. The rest of the country is in the hands of warlords, and most of those warlords are as bad, in some cases even worse, if that can be possible, than the Taliban. So the situation for women in the country hasn't really improved. There was a very brief flowering just after the U.S. invasion, and ever since there's been a real backlash, and most of their freedoms have been taken away.
And of course, we talk all about Iraq, but American boys are still dying in Afghanistan. And of course, the country is totally chaotic. And you'll be happy to know, of course, that the opium crop is back to full production, maybe better than ever. And we control the country. And I'd like to ask people, what's wrong with this scenario?
Yeah, there was just a news report today or yesterday announcing yet again a bumper crop, record crop in Afghanistan for opium, which can be turned into heroin. And a remarkable thing is that other soldiers, for instance, French soldiers and British soldiers, have complained to the media saying, we drive by opium fields all the time, and our U.S. command says we're not allowed to do anything about it.
I wonder why. Well, a lot of people have suggested that the CIA, this is really a CIA-controlled war. There's some people who say that the CIA is the largest drug smuggler in the world, and of course it gets its money for its secret wars, like the war in Afghanistan in the 80s, from the black operations and from drugs. But that's a little off the subject. Anyway, of course, where does Osama bin Laden come from, and what is his relationship to the Taliban?
Well, he, as I said before, he in the early 1980s over to Afghanistan, and he took part in the war there for about 10 years. Then he kind of bounced around, ended up in Sudan for a long period of time. And in 1996, he went back to Afghanistan. And ironically, the United States had a very big role in him going back to Afghanistan, because we basically told the government of Sudan that bin Laden has to leave your country. And so they said, okay. And there's a long story there. But in essence, he got on an airplane with all of his followers, all of his money, his family, and the United States knew. They even allowed the country of Qatar in the Persian Gulf to have landing rights for this airplane as it made its way to Afghanistan. And people have pointed out since it was a golden opportunity to basically in one fell swoop get rid of all of Al-Qaeda, and it was an opportunity we missed.
Well, of course, there were, if you read Richard Miniter's book, there were at least a 11 different times. We could have taken out Osama bin Laden, but there were people in government who didn't want to take out Osama bin Laden, didn't want to capture him, and you have to ask yourself, why would that be? We'll be right back here in just a moment. We have a brand new video today on the Oklahoma City bombing. It's called Oklahoma, What Really Happened. And of course, it consists of a lot of never-before-seen video footage. Now, it was seen in Oklahoma City immediately following the bombing of the Mall building, but blacked out across America. And in this footage, you're going to see the commentators talking about the other bombs that were in the building at the time of the initial bombing. We're told, of course, that Timothy McVeigh acted independently. We're told many things by the media, but wherein does the truth lie? Oklahoma City, what really happened, it will give you the opportunity to see long suppressed video footage of what really transpired. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR and ask for Oklahoma City, what really happened.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. A secret of healthy aging was recently found among people who have lived unusually long, healthy lives. The longest-lived woman, Jean Calment of France, who lived 122 years, and man, Antonio Todd of the Italian Isle of Sardinia, who lived 115 years, as well as the Queen Mother of England, who lived 100 years, outliving one of her daughters by 3 decades, was their daily consumption of red wine. But health authorities have been reticent to recommend an alcoholic beverage to the public at large until now. Longevinex is the world's first stabilized French red wine extract in a pill, without the calories and without the alcohol or sulfite preservatives. One Longevinex capsule provides the red wine molecules found in 5 glasses of the best red wine. Call 866-405-4000 to order Longevinex. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Tieri. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done, get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. We're talking to Paul Thompson. His book is Terror Timeline. We do carry that here at Radio Liberty, and it's pretty close, 400 or 500 pages? Paul?
600 pages.
600 pages. Well, it's a big book, and it's got a lot of great information in it. We're talking about Osama. Pick up the story.
Hello?
Go ahead. Do you want to pick up the story? We were talking about Osama bin Laden. We were just saying that there were so many opportunities to eliminate Osama bin Laden. Why? Because, of course, we knew that he was had been involved with the 911, with the Black Hawk Down attack in October of 93. He was involved with the first World Trade Center bombing. He was involved with attacks on trying to kill Americans in Aden in 1992. He was involved with certainly with many of the other terrorist activities. So we certainly had every reason and justification for trying to either arrest him or trying to assassinate him. And President Clinton, by his own admission on 60 Minutes, and we have it from many other sources, certainly Richard Clark's book, Going Against All Enemies, talks about how the president has authorized the intelligence agencies to either kill or capture Osama bin Laden. And they refused to do it.
Well, if I could point out, we were talking about how he moved to Afghanistan in 1996, and everything in my my timeline is referenced from mainstream sources, and I have a quote in there from some government official who said that you know, the United States, from time to time, if they really want somebody, they just put them in a bag and whisk them out of the country. You know, they don't worry about legal niceties. But in this case, somebody didn't want this to happen, meaning the arrest or death of Osama bin Laden. And the excuse that they said why they didn't get him at that time when he was leaving Sudan was they said that they didn't have a legal case against him, so that if they would have had them, it could have been an embarrassment because they wouldn't have been able to put him on trial. But as you point out, this is pretty ridiculous. There were many cases you were pointing out, the attack in Aden and many others, which by this time the United States was aware of, and they were aware of Osama bin Laden's role in all these things. They certainly could have put together a criminal trial against him if they wanted to. But in any case, so he goes to Afghanistan, and he immediately allies with the Taliban. They're of a very like religious and philosophical bent. And he and the Taliban work very closely together in many aspects, one of which not a lot of people know about is the drug trade. They took a percent of all the drug profits that were leaving the country, and that was a big source of revenue. And to this day, I should mention that all these drugs that are being produced in Afghanistan, some estimate that is the largest source of terrorist funding in the world, and yet the United States isn't doing anything about it.
You really have to wonder about that. Well, let's get to the time that's leading up to the 911 attack. One of the most interesting stories you told, which I had never heard the full story, was this gentleman who walks into the FBI office in April of 2000. This is, what, about a year and 4 or 5 months before the 911 attack. And he announces, I'm a terrorist. I'm here to blow up your planes and crash them into buildings. Would you like to tell that story and how the FBI reacted when one of the members of Al-Qaeda, who was trained to hijack our planes and crash them into buildings, goes to the FBI and says, I'm here. This is the story. What happened to him?
Yeah, his name is Niaz Khan, and his story made the media a few months ago, especially in Britain, where he lives to this day. And he basically came out and admitted his role in all this, and the FBI confirmed his account. So this is very solid information. As he was a compulsive gambler, had a bunch of money Al-Qaeda gave him, and when he came to the U.S., instead of taking part in the operation they had planned for him, he spent it all in Atlantic City gambling, felt very worried that they would try to get him for doing that, and so he turned himself over to the FBI. When he came to the U.S., he was supposed to meet five or six others, and he was told they were all going to take part in an attack eventually, they didn't say when, but eventually leaving from New York City on an airplane and then crashing that airplane into a building.
And basically, they had been trained how to hijack the plane. I mean, it wasn't a 747 they were going to hijack, something like that?
A jumbo jet, and okay. He had gone to Pakistan, and he trained in Pakistan with others for several weeks, I believe 2 weeks, on hijacking techniques, but he was apparently going to do more training in the U.S.
All right, fine. So what did the FBI do? Now, here they've got a man. He's in Al-Qaeda. Of course, we said we could never get into Al-Qaeda, but this guy turns himself in and wants to tell us what's going to happen. So what do? Do they use him to track down the rest of the hijackers?
No, they don't. He's in custody, I believe, about 2-3 weeks, and they find his story so incredible, they give him several lie detectors to test. He passes them all. According to some accounts in the media, there was an NBC account stating that the
hold
the
up,
FBI,
hold that there.
Oh, sure.
Our 4 tapes set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination. A 2-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president. And then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out. And if you listen to this 4-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
Hi, my name is Michael Anthony Perugia, and I approved of this ad. I'm seeking the presidential nomination of the Constitution Party, and one of the reasons I'm running is to put the interest of American workers first, which President Bush is not doing. Mr. Bush has advocated an immigration plan that would let millions of illegal aliens stay in our country, and the chairman of his Council of Economic Advisors has praised what is called outsourcing, which will send millions of American jobs overseas. In other words, Mr. Bush is importing illegal cheap labor and exporting good-paying jobs that should stay in America. Well, this makes no sense. Such policies are outrageous at a time when so many Americans are looking for jobs and want to work. The sad fact is that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats are looking out for American workers first. As president, I would put our people first. I hope you'll look at my webpage, Perutka2004.com, that's Perutka2004.com, and remember, you never waste your vote when you vote for what's right.
Authorized and paid for by Perutka 2004.
The Midwest Gift and Fudge House manufactures the best fudge in the world. They've discovered a secret recipe, and it allowed them to actually make the creamiest and most delicious fudge you're going to find anywhere. They also have a sugar-free type of fudge that has a great creamy taste, and yet it's safe for diabetics. The fudge is made daily, and there are over 30 to 40 different flavors in the store every single day. Midwest Fudge makes a perfect gift for any occasion, and makes even a better treat for you. It's shipped out daily, so you're always guaranteed the freshest fudge. So why not place your order by calling 866-526-5419. That's 866-526-5419. Or visit their website at www.worldfamousfudge.com. That's worldfamousfudge.com. Your order will be shipped out the next day. And, of course, they're open 7 days a week. Why don't you stop by and visit them there from 9 in the morning until 9... Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. We're talking with Paul Thompson about his book, Terror Timeline, and there's a great deal of great information, and we're talking about this incident. Now, there was only covered recently, but actually, if you go back and you read Eleanor Hill's testimony before the Joint Select Committee, of course, it was totally censored by the controlled media, but we have copies of it, and we want the page, why we can send that to you. Eleanor Hill testified that in April of 2000, Islamic Al-Qaeda terrorist comes in to the FBI and says, here I am, I want to help you, and instead of using him to track down the rest of the terrorists, which would be the logical thing to do if you were trying to stop a terrorist attack, what did they do at that point, Paul?
Yeah, so according to some media accounts, the local FBI was very interested in this person, but FBI headquarters sent back a message saying, get rid of him. So they shipped them back to Britain, and they handed them over to British intelligence. British intelligence wasn't interested in him either, and after a couple hours, they just let him go back onto the street and said, good luck. So it's really remarkable that neither intelligence agency took advantage of this incredible opportunity.
Well, of course, you list in your book the fact that so many different countries kept telling us there's going to be an attack, a terrorist attack on the United States. But, of course, our leaders said, oh, we had no idea an attack was coming. Well, we thought maybe there'd be one overseas, but there was no indication there was going to be an attack here. But what did they really know about the attack ahead of time that they can't let the American people know?
Well, one thing that I thought the 9/11 Commission did surprisingly well is they mentioned in their final report that in the summer of 2001, Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan was actually publicly talking about the 9/11 attacks in front of large crowds of followers in mosques and other places in the training camps. He said things like, "Let's send a prayer to the 20 martyrs on their mission." And he said other things such as, there will be an attack coming soon that will kill thousands in the United States. So although the United States, according to media accounts, I'm not sure about this, but according to media accounts, they didn't have a single undercover operative in Afghanistan. Other countries did. Many of our allies did, Egypt being one of them. And those other countries tried to warn us. There were about a dozen foreign government warnings, according to various newspaper accounts. And many of these warnings were quite specific. For instance, the Egyptian warning mentioned on 60 Minutes on CBS, Egypt told the CIA there are 20 people in the U.S. planning an attack in the United States right now. Four of them are training on light aircraft in the United States. If you look at some of the other warnings, from the foreign governments, they talked about multiple simultaneous hijackings. They talked about the use of airplanes as flying weapons in the United States. They mentioned hitting large symbolic targets in the United States. Some of them specifically mentioned the World Trade Center. There was no one warning that put it all together and said on September 11th, these following buildings will be hit. But there was a lot of very specific, actionable warnings that were seemingly completely ignored.
Yeah, but you know,
Norman Mineta, the transportation secretary for Bush, he was asked by the 9/11 Commission, did the Bush administration, can you point to one thing the Bush administration did to generally protect the country against a terror attack? And he said, no, we can't point to a single thing. And yet all these warnings were coming in. These foreign government warnings, they were just part of a larger stream of warnings coming all over.
Well, of course, the thing that really is so concerning is that there's ordinarily a presidential daily briefing from the intelligence services, and that information under the Clinton administration went to a large number of people. But under the Bush administration, I think there were only six people who got the warning, so nobody really knew what was happening. In fact, on the 6th of August, they got this PDB, and we have copies if anybody wants to read it. It says, Osama bin Laden are determined to strike the United States. And there are, I think, 10 or 12 paragraphs there in that briefing. And 10 of them deal with hijacking planes, attacking here in the United States, Washington, D.C., New York City. It's all there. 10 of the 12 paragraphs deal with that. And they knew they were planning on hijacking planes and using them as weapons. And yet, absolutely nothing was done. The president has said, oh, if I thought this was going to happen, I would have done anything I could have to stop it. But all they had to do was, of course, tell the pilots this was going to happen. They didn't tell the pilots. Tell the stewardesses was going to happen. Increase security at the airports. Actually, they decreased the security. They actually deprived the pilots of the right to carry weapons just 2 months before the attack when they knew one was coming. Why would they do something? Why did they take all the marshals off of all of our planes? Why didn't they reinforce the doors? Why didn't they do any of the logical things to stop a hijacking when they knew they were planning on doing that, or at least the potential for doing that? When you, after doing all of your study, Paul, what conclusion can you come to why they didn't do any of the logical things? Is it just that they're stupid? The process broke down? If the process broke down, why has nobody been fired?
Well, I'd like to point out about a few things that you just mentioned. One, you slightly misquoted the title, and it's important to get it right. You said bin Laden determined to strike the United States, when in fact it was bin Laden determined to strike in the United States. Right. So that's very, that word is very important. And in fact, Ari Fleischer, the press secretary, tried to bamboozle the media and miss inaccurate reading of the title when it first came out. So, you know, it was clear from the title alone that this wasn't some overseas attack, which is what another official repeated lie we hear over and over again, which is that they claim that they only thought that the attack was going to come overseas. Another thing I wanted to point out from what you mentioned is that there's the presidential daily briefing, and then after that, there's another briefing that generally gets released the next day and gets to a much wider audience of hundreds of people. And the really interesting information, the active information in the presidential daily briefing that day, it was not included in the next briefing that went out to the larger crowd. So, you know, this was said to be very...
Are you there? Well, I think we just lost our guest, so we'll hope that we'll call right back or we'll try to get him. But this is the thing, that they withholding information. Now, the FAA says that they sent out directives to the airlines, but the airlines never got that. Who could have intercepted that information? You know, the FBI said that they were sending out information, but it never got to the local offices. The CIA said that they were disseminating information, but somebody was blocking its dissension. Do you think that we had Al-Qaeda operatives working within our government blocking the transmission of information, or the alternative would be that there were people in our government who were blocking the dissemination of information, so there would be no effective opposition to what happened? Those are the only two alternatives I can think of. Maybe if you're in the audience, you can think of others. And then, of course, there were actually war games that day to confuse the people who were the air traffic controller, and there were actually planes in the air that morning pretending to be defending us against an armed attack on the United States from within using airplanes. Isn't it amazing that that's never been picked up by the general media? Did you get into that aspect of it at all, Paul, the fact that there were war games apparently that morning?
Yes, I did. It's a bit shrouded in mystery. There seem to have been at least three war games going on that morning. One was taking place at agency called the National Reconnaissance Office, and they were actually doing an exercise that morning that envisioned a plane crashing into their building.
A plane crashing into their building, but we had no idea that this could happen. This was a war game, to make believe. Go ahead.
Yeah, this wasn't exactly a war game. This was more like an exercise, much like a fire drill, that was actually scheduled to happen at 9 o'clock in the morning, just a few miles away from where, you know, the real planes were taking off. But in addition, there are at least two other war games that we know of that are real war games. One is called Vigilant Guardian, and the other one is called Northern Vigilance. And one thing that may be the case, although it's hard to confirm, is that it seems like at least one of these war games may have drawn many of the fighters out to the remote borders of Canada, so that there weren't as many planes as usual defending the country. And intriguingly, Northern Vigilance may have involved actual fake radar blips on the radar screens of at least NORAD, the military responders, because I found one article where they say that at 9 o'clock, realizing that there was a real attack on, they took off the false radar blips. So that, to me, is a very significant fact that not a lot of people know about, because for 40 minutes by that time, you would have the real hijackers flying around and NORAD being notified for at least about 30 minutes, and yet you have false radar blips of pretend hijackings confusing the responders at the same time.
Gee, that was really very fortunate for the hijackers that they just happened to just have their hijacking on the day that they were having war games and pretending that there were going to be a hijacking or other attacks on America. That was almost really a great asset, so they could confuse the air traffic controllers, or maybe the Al-Qaeda weren't fortunate. Maybe people knew the attack was coming. Is there any way we can know that they had they been told that there would be an attack specifically on any specific day? Was there any information like the warning of Mayor Willie Brown the night before? He should be very careful flying on that day, or Salman Rushdie, or the officials in the Defense Department? What would tend to pin down that very day?
Well, there's I have a whole section on the website version of the timeline at www.cooperativeresearch.org. I organized it a little bit differently when it came out in the book, but I have a whole section that is specifically warnings indicated the exact day or roughly around the time that would happen. One of them is a very famous warning that made a lot of news, where there was a message the day before saying, tomorrow is 0 hour. And the claim is that specific warning wasn't translated in time. But there were a whole slew of warnings. Different people who were in the United States had foreknowledge. And you can even look at President Bush, who very curiously, I found this very obscure mention in a magazine, that when he was staying in Sarasota, Florida, the night before the attacks, there were surface-to-air missiles on the roof of his hotel, which is a very unusual, non-standard measure to be taking when the president is traveling, as far as I know. So it would seem that there were some people in the U.S. who were certainly very concerned. There's the case also of Ashcroft, about a month and a half before, stops flying commercially. There's just a whole slew of evidence. Another one I think you're aware of is the Salman Rushdie warning, where he was warned, the famous author Salman Rushdie was warned not to fly that very day, that very week. He was told that from a few days before that he couldn't fly domestically in the U.S. So there's just a whole slew of clues that should have pointed out not only the method of attack and the likely targets of the attack, but also the rough timing of the attack.
Well, what about this warning that was given to Mayor Willie Brown of San Francisco, or the warning that was given to the high military officers who canceled their flights for the 12th of September on the 10th of, pardon me, for the 11th of September on the 10th of September? You cover both of those in your book.
Yeah, and Newsweek reported the one about the generals canceling their flight because of some warning they'd been given. And Newsweek went on to say, no doubt the fact that these generals were warned but the American public wasn't warned will be a subject of debate in the weeks to come. And as we all know, there was no such thing. That story was repeated again in the next issue of Newsweek. They're still trying to make an issue of it. And then again, the story just dies. It seems hardly anybody notices this. There are a whole bunch of stories like this that came after 9/11 that were quite shocking, and they just seemed to die. I noticed another account in the Miami Herald, where they had a columnist there saying the incredible failure to have the fighters stop the attacks no doubt will be the subject of great debate. And that, too, was a subject which seemed was taboo and nobody even wanted to discuss.
Why they sent the flyers of the planes rather than bringing them in from Andrews Air Force Base, 2 minutes from Washington, D.C., why they brought them in from Langley, but they didn't bring them in from Langley. They sent them out over the Atlantic. And then they had them fly at subsonic speeds. The Pentagon is under attack. They've evacuated the White House, but they don't evacuate the Pentagon. What was Donald Rumsfeld doing when America was under attack? Well, he was sitting in his office doing absolutely nothing. The story really doesn't make sense, does it, as you look at it, Paul?
No, and this is what drove me to write this book, because I just found one thing after another that just literally amazed me. For instance, you're talking about the failure of Rumsfeld and others to act. We have Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Defense Secretary. He actually states to the media that after he was told the second plane had hit the World Trade Center, he said, seemed like there wasn't much we could do, so we just went back to the previously scheduled meeting. I mean, these are people in the very top of the military chain of command. The country is under attack. According to Rumsfeld, he's told about the second World Trade Center hit, and he goes ahead with his regularly scheduled CIA daily morning briefing all the way until the Pentagon is hit. This doesn't make sense. These people are supposed to be very hands-on. When the country is being attacked, they seem to have no concern whatsoever.
Well, there are lots of strange and unanswered questions, and I think you raise an awful lot of more questions, but you have a tremendous volume of very informative information. I know I learned a lot about this, the attack, by reading what you had and then compiling with what I already knew, and I think that you come up with a conclusion that there is no way they could not have known the attack was coming on the United States, and knowing the attack was coming and having a plan on the president's desk to attack Afghanistan on the very morning of September 11th, why, of course, this was very, very convenient, because now we could justify going to war. But, of course, not just with Afghanistan. Afghanistan was simply the justification. Then we had to go to war with Iraq. And of course, the next place will be with Iran and with Syria, and they're going to draft your sons and daughters. I have no question at all. And you better become involved, and you better get the facts, and you better help us get the information out. Paul, I want to thank you so very much for being our guest three times, and certainly for writing this great book and for all the research that you have done.
Well, thanks a lot for having me.
And did you ever get that copy of Jihad in America that we sent to you?
No, I haven't, but I look forward to it.
All right, we'll get to that and that one article on Operation Vajinka, published about 2 months before the attack, talking about hijacking planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center. But Condoleezza Rice had no idea it could happen. Hey, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, that was certainly Paul Thompson, and I'm sorry we've got Marilyn calling from Sacramento, but, of course, she wants to hang on. Maybe we could talk to her just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when we have to talk to you a little bit about some of the items we have. Let's go ahead and talk to you a little bit about the book that has been written. It's called Terror Timeline, The Terror Timeline, and it's written by Paul Thompson. We think it's an excellent book. We're carrying it. Really, it gives you a day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute, a summary of what happened that terrible, terrible day. So we'll be talking about that. And right now, let's, of course, go to Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn. Do you have a quick question? Marilyn, are you there? Marilyn, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
I certainly can. Go ahead.
Okay, good. Yes, I'm concerned about Barbara Olson, you know, who died in the crash.
Hold that thought for just a minute. All right, fine. This is Dr. Stan. The line is Barbara Olson. She's asking about, pardon me, the line is Marilyn from Sacramento. She's calling about Barbara Olson, who had actually interviewed, and she was a lovely lady. She had married Ted Sorensen, Solicitor General of the country. Yeah, go ahead. Ted Sorensen, I think it was. Anyway, what was your question?
Well, my question is, you know, I wonder why she wasn't told, or why Ted Olson wasn't told. If Ashcroft was told and Willie Brown was told, and I do believe that that did happen. I think that's documented, at least certainly about Willie Brown being knowing about this and others. But do you think they intended for Barbara Olson to be on that plane, because she had written a book called The Final Days about the last days of the Clintons and all of the crimes they committed as they were leaving the White House. Anyway, I've never quite gotten over the idea that Barbara Olson can, coincidentally enough, out of those very few people who were on the plane, happened to be one of them.
And of course, the thing is that they did warn certain people that morning. They did warn Willie Brown the night before. I know, because I talked to his press secretary to confirm the story. My friend Dennis Cuddy talked to the editor of Newsweek magazine about the warning of the generals the day before. And the editor of Newsweek magazine said, I don't want to talk about that. I will not talk about that. Why do you think he didn't want to talk about it? I think he got an offer he couldn't refuse. Hey, thanks so very much for calling, Marilyn.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up today's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is the time when we have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day, trying to make people think. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to war with Iran. There's no question we're going to war with Iran. How do I know that? Because I go to the websites of the people who are part of the Project for the New American Century, the secret little group that controls our government today. And you can go to at least the master website, which is newamericancentury.org. If you care about your children, your grandchildren, go to the website. Get their information, read it through, and if you need help reading it, you go to my my website of RadioLiberty.com and get some of the articles I've written about the Project for the New American Century, so you know how to read their material. But if not, of course, you can get it, much of this summarized in our Iraq the Untold Story syllabus, but you don't have to buy that. You can go to their website. But if you go to, for instance, Frank Gaffney's website, and you will find that every day Gaffney is part of this group. He's a propagandist for it, and he's writing about how Iran is threatening to attack America. Now, why do you think Iran is threatening to attack America? Do they have a death wish? No. This is how they're going to draw us into this war. I mean, after all, Saddam Hussein was never a threat to America, but Iran has nuclear weapons. They're not telling her that, but she has nuclear weapons. She has missiles that will go 2,000 miles. It could hit Europe, and she also has some submarines that could hit our coast. And so Iran is a very real threat, and, of course, we're going to war with Iran. It's only a matter of time. It's going to be a terrible and bloody war. And, of course, your children are going to be there because they're going to reinstitute the draft. And you better get involved in this. The men and women become accomplices to evils they fail to oppose. I've said it before. I will say it again. You better get involved, because the price of silence may very well be the death of your loved ones and the destruction of this country. So first find out if we're really telling you the truth. Do you need to get my video and the syllabus? You can get them separately if you want to. Iraq, the Untold Story. How they got us into the Spanish-American War? They lied. How they got us into the First World War? They lied. How they got us into the Second World War? They lied. How they got us into Korea? They lied. How they got us into Vietnam? There wasn't any Gulf of Tonkin incident. How did they get us into the First Gulf War? They talked Saddam Hussein into attacking Kuwait. And then when he did, why, we had a war. And how did they get us into this war? Why, of course, the weapons of mass destruction. Everybody knows. The president told us there were weapons of mass destruction. And he wouldn't lie to us. Well, it was, of course, the faulty intelligence. Well, we could go into that in great detail. Actually, there were weapons of mass destruction, and a lot of them went to Iran, and they went to Syria, and they went to Lebanon. And one of these days, they're going to find that out, and they're going to say, oh, that's how we have to go to war with these countries. Ladies and gentlemen, we're moving into World War III. Do you really care? Well, check the facts out. Check the history. Iraq, the Untold Story, the video, the syllabus, give you the documentation. Go to my website and read the articles that we have there, and then determine if this is really true. And if it is, then commit yourself to join us in this epic struggle to determine if this nation or any nation under God can long endure. You need to get our video, The Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get our 4-tape set on the secret government. You need to get our special on the secret government. You need to get our special on the pagan agenda. You need to get our material on Satanism and deliverance on Aleister Crowley. You need to get the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll. The 4-hour or the 10-hour version. There's so much material there. But you have to get it. You have to get convinced, and then you have to join us. Remember, we're having an all-day seminar on the 6th of November at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course here in the Santa Cruz area, if you can possibly make it. We hope you can. Lunch will be served. You'll have to make a reservation. We have to know how many people are coming. We're bringing in outside speakers, great speakers. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. For a free copy of our newsletter, a catalog, for your reservations for the all-day seminar on the 6th of November, Saturday the 6th of November. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and ministers. Pray for our boys over in Vietnam. And pray for the people who are dying there needlessly. Till tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.